This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, who has some thoughts about the government shutdown that I'm sure he will share. And his latest book focuses on the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy 50 years ago next month. Jesse Ventura's book is called They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. Also, Baton Rouge actor John Meese. He received his MFA in acting from LSU, moved to Los Angeles. He's become a star of sorts, and he is back in his home state for the premiere of The King of Herrings at the Britannia Theater. And John Meese, along with several other Louisiana actors, are featured. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined by James George Janus, better known as Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, author, veteran, former professional wrestler, a man who has served his country with distinction and has some questions about the U.S. government that he has detailed in previous books. His latest work is They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. Good morning, Governor Ventura.
Good morning, Jim. Nice to be here.
Nice to talk with you, as always. You were 12 years old on 22 November 1963. Do you recall the assassination at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's a kid in America that doesn't recall it, because I was in seventh grade junior high school, and I remember at about 12:30 when initially the ambush took place in Dallas. They sent us all back to our homerooms, and they told us that there had been an assassination attempt against the president. And then at 1 o'clock, of course, the famous Walter Cronkite television interviewer that you saw Walter announced that indeed the president was dead. I remember they told us to immediately go home, and they were closing school, and I bet that's the first time that junior high school kids did what they were told, because to my recollection, we all did that. We went immediately home.
You called it an ambush. How many people do you think were firing away at JFK on that day?
Certainly multiple shooters, no doubt. I mean, I've been studying this diligently. It's been my passion since about 1985, and in looking at the facts and reading things that a lot of things the government doesn't want you to know. There's no doubt in my mind that there were multiple shooters down there. We have quotes in the book from the initial over-the-radio police response from, like, the county sheriff and the head of the Dallas PD, who were riding a couple vehicles in front of Kennedy when it all erupted. And immediately, we verbatim, we've got it in the book, over their radios, they were instructing all of their police officers to get to the grassy knoll. Because the fact that they all testified that two shots came almost on top of each other. Bam, bam. And if you follow that testimony and the audio that came out on the police radio that was left on, clearly it couldn't have come from the Oswald rifle, because you had to work the bolt and you could not physically shoot a weapon like that quickly. Because it was a bolt-action weapon. And so when you start adding up, and these are just a small amount of facts, when you start adding them up like jigsaw puzzle, pretty soon it becomes abundantly clear to you that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the sole assassin, and certainly didn't do this remarkable thing all by his lonesome self.
Do you think he was involved at all?
I think, yeah, in what he said he was, a patsy. What happened that day was a coup d'etat, a change in the government, and it didn't happen at the ballot box. It happened with a bullet. And any time there's a coup d'etat, number one, you can never have a trial, because then the conspirators can be recognized and found out. So there can never be a trial, and there always has to be someone to blame. The public needs some figure to hate to blame for this horrible event that took place, and I think Oswald was just what he said he was, a patsy. I mean, look how he was treated in prison or in jail. They interviewed this guy. They arrested him on Friday, and they had him all the way till Sunday, and there isn't one recorded interview with him. Now, come on. You know, you're talking, homicide 101 here. How could there not be any notes? How come no one wasn't recording the questions and the answers? Clearly because they didn't want any record of what Oswald said behind closed doors or what they asked him behind closed doors. And that's just not standard operating procedure. And when you look at conspiracies involving the government, as Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty said and educated us, always look for the violation of standard operating procedures, whether it's military or civilian government. That's how they run. And so when you apply standard operating procedures to this murder, they're violated in so many places that you clearly see something wasn't right.
Based on your extensive research, Jesse Ventura, author of They Killed Our President, which, by the way, is in bookstores all over this area and elsewhere, who did it?
Well, you know, the who did it, we list you scenarios of many people who could have been, you know, involved and were involved. I think the better question is that I can tell you, because it's been 50 years, I think the better answer I can give you is who didn't do it? Lee Harvey Oswald. And that opens the gate because, of course, naturally, there's no statute of limitations on murder. You could technically open this case back up today. And in fact, let's look at the government's official investigation, the most current official investigation, which was the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the mid-70s. Right in their conclusion, we printed in the book that they even determined it was a conspiracy.
You've been to the sixth floor of the school book depository. You've sat.
Yes, I have.
I've been there too. You, of course, have military experience that I do not have. You're convinced that Oswald couldn't have done it.
Well, he couldn't make the shots. Fidel Castro agreed with me on that. And don't take my word for it. Even though on my TV show we tried to recreate it using the same weapon, and I couldn't do it, and I'm an expert marksman. Look at the history. Oswald goes into the Marine Corps. Well, when you join the military, they give you batteries of tests because they're not dumb. They want to channel you where your abilities can be used in the best fashion while you serve your country. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't 0300 infantry. He was a radar technician. In other words, and don't get me wrong, because I'm an old knuckle dragger, but that's a pencil pusher. He didn't even, I bet he barely carried a weapon the entire time he was in the Marine Corps except boot camp. He was a radar man. And don't take my word on the shooting. Go to the book and read about the greatest Marine Corps sniper in history. He's legendary, Carlos Hathcock, the former head instructor at Quantico, the Marine Sniper School. He attempted 10 times to duplicate Oswald's shooting, and he couldn't do it. Read his quotes in the book. Now, this is a man that made his living being the greatest sniper in U.S. history. And he can't do it, but a radar technician can. You know, when you apply something very elementary like common sense to all of this, it doesn't pass through. It doesn't pass muster. When you look at when Oswald was arrested. The only thing they knew about him was that a fellow merchant had seen him sneak in the side of the theater and not pay. So he calls the police, informing the police of that, and they send 10 squad cars, 24 cops, and the news media to arrest a guy who the only thing they knew about him was he didn't buy a ticket into the Texas afternoon matinee. Then let's apply common sense to Oswald himself. You've just shot the president. You've just wounded the governor, allegedly. You run down 6 flights of stairs, and what's the first thing you do? You have a Coke and a smile. Because when Oswald was confronted 90 seconds after the shooting, he was in the second floor lunchroom holding a Coke. Now, that has to be the greatest ad for Coca-Cola in history. You know, what's the first thing you do? Have a Coke and a smile. Then, as the shooter, you've killed the president, allegedly, and you decide what, to go to the afternoon matinee movie?
Well, he could be hiding out in the theater.
Well, no, in the movie theater? Why would you hide out in public? If I had shot the president, I'd be in a basement or be getting out of town.
Well, I don't know what kind of options he had, but you don't even believe that he brought a gun into the school book depository that day.
Absolutely not, because I held the Mannlicher Tarcano. I shot it. They said that the Warren Commission said he carried it under his arms and told his coworker it was curtain rods. I'm 6'4". The Mannlicher Tarcano, I'm looking at it right now, a picture of one. It has a long, unusually long wood stock. The thing's it comes to within 5 to 6 inches of the end of the barrel. You can imagine on a stock like that. If you break it down, I'm 6'4". There's no way I can cup it in my hand and carry it under my armpit like they claimed Oswald carried these curtain rods. Oswald, at most, he's been measured at different heights, but the largest they've ever had him was 5'10". So I'm 6 inches taller than Lee Harvey Oswald, and there's no way that I could carry the Mannlicher Tarcano broke down under my armpit. It don't fit. Mm-hmm. You could be Kevin Garnett at 7 feet tall, and I doubt you could get it, cup it in your hand and hold it under your armpit.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, and we will take some inquiries for Governor Ventura, Governor of Minnesota, 1999 to 2003, Mayor of Brooklyn Park, one of the largest cities in Minnesota, 91 to 95, and U.S. Navy, 1969 to 1973. Navy SEAL, Vietnam veteran, and yet you have become a critic of our government. Did you have these kinds of feelings when you were a member of the armed forces?
Well, you don't have time to have those types of feelings. You know, you're trained to do a job. You're serving your country. That's the sad thing about being in the military. They become victims of political failure. You know, I today believe that any war is the failure of politicians. They fail, so you end up at war. And in the military, you're not granted that. You don't get the luxury of criticizing your government, or, you know, you've signed on to do the job you're going to do, and you got to do it. So when I was in the Navy, I focused on doing my job, and I was not that. The only time I ever got political, really, was I spent a year being trained. I deployed overseas for 9 months. I came home, and I had been back 1 week, and I went into my executive offer and said I wanted to go immediately back overseas. And he said, well, you can't do that. You've got to rotate a year back here before you can deploy again, minimum. He said, what's the problem? And I said, the problem is I'm a child here. I said, overseas, I was an adult. I couldn't vote, nor could I consume a beer, because I was underage. And that was after 1 year of being trained in the military and then spending a 9-month tour overseas, because at that time it was pre-1972, where the voting age was 21, and of course California had a drinking age of 21. So I guess I was still a child. Shouldn't that be a case of child abuse, Jim?
Well, you win.
You can die for your country, but you're not old enough to be considered an adult. And we have it today. The hypocrisy exists today. Look at the NBA. The NBA passed a rule now so these kids can't go directly from high school to the pros, like the aforementioned Kevin Garnett. And they have to go to college now for a year. And like Jermaine O'Neal said, you got to be kidding me. A kid could go die in Iraq at 18, but he can't play in the NBA. So it's hypocrisy and double standard like that I always like to expose and fight.
Well, Jesse Ventura, he walked the walk when he was 18. He volunteered, went in the U.S. Navy, and fought heroically for our country. And has had
Jim, let me throw something in. I got in on the tail end. I, you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on by the time I got over there. We were already in a withdrawal, or as Nixon called it, peace with honor. And I'm happy for that today, because I certainly wouldn't have wanted to added my name to the 58,000 that died in that useless Vietnam War.
Did you kill anybody?
You don't ask anyone that.
Well, I just asked, but you don't want to.
Well, don't do that. You don't. That's not something that I don't think any veteran would tell you. That's the worst question you can ask us.
297-5633, back in 90 seconds with the incomparable Jesse Ventura. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org for Governor Jesse Ventura. Back with another book, bound to be a bestseller. In fact, it already is. They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Kill JFK. Some of the endorsements for Jesse Ventura. George Stephanopoulos says, Jesse Ventura never shies away from a fight. Howard Stern says, you're my hero, man. Jesse Ventura, why was President Kennedy, in your judgment, a man who was a target of his own government? What had he done to deserve this?
Well, that's a great question, Jim. And President Kennedy made a tremendous amount of enemies in his short term in office. Naturally, the mafia did not like him. They felt he had been betrayed because there's these stories that Joe Kennedy made a deal with Giancana in Chicago to bring Kennedy the Illinois election, and Giancana did it, and that was critical in Kennedy defeating Nixon for the presidency. And the other part was that Bobby Kennedy was the attorney general under Jack, and Bobby had started waging war on the mafia, you know, actually deporting Carlos Marcello, the mafia don down there in your neck of the woods of New Orleans. And so the mafia didn't like him. The joint chiefs in the Pentagon didn't like him because he would not go to war in Cuba. And he, very likely there would not have been a Vietnam War because he had already ordered the first 1,000 advisors out by Christmas. And off the record, he had told people that after he was reelected, we would be out of Vietnam completely no later than 65. So he had enemies. The Pentagon wanted to go to war. I mean, wait till you read this stuff of the things they presented to Jack Kennedy. It was absurd, like a first strike against the Soviet Union with nuclear war. And one of them is quoted as saying, if there's two of us alive and one of them, then we win. I mean, what kind of mentality is that? So he had enemy there. He had enemy from the CIA after the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy inherited the Bay of Pigs from the Eisenhower administration. He went along with it and then realized the CIA had lied to him. So he made the quote he was going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and he did so. Started by firing Allen Dulles, Cabell, and I forget the third sacred cow, the three old heads of the CIA. He fired them. So he had the CIA hating him. And naturally, it was the Kennedys who first brought civil rights strongly into the South. So, you know, the South wasn't too pleased with him. So Jack Kennedy had a tremendous amount of enemies while he was in office that short period of time. And let's not forget Lyndon Baines Johnson. When you read some of the stuff on President Johnson, I mean, two conspiracies took place, Jim. There was the first conspiracy to actually murder the president, and then the second conspiracy was the government cover-up afterwards. So two conspiracies happened.
Well, the House Committee Select Committee on Assassinations concluded that Carlos Marcello, the man you mentioned, the mob boss from New Orleans, had the motive, means, and opportunity to assassinate the president. And, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans shortly before the president was killed. What about Marcello? Is he a possibility?
He's a possibility of participation. In fact, he admitted to participating, you know. But let's remember something. The mafia couldn't cover it up. The mafia couldn't change the parade route. There's many things that they would be incapable of doing. They couldn't have got the Secret Service to go to sleep that day. Wait till you see what's great about this book. When it's available at the bottom of paragraphs, we show you in the book where you can go on the internet to view or hear this stuff yourself. And one of the bombshells in this book that was new to me, we have a tape of Kennedy at Love Field getting ready to leave on the parade, or whatever you want to call it. And standard operating procedure that we talked about earlier, the Secret Service is supposed to ride on the bumper. Well, you see a young Secret Service guy get on the bumper, then you see him ordered off by his superior, whom we name in the book. And the young Secret Service man throws his arms out to the side, palms up in the air like he's saying, what's going on here? And also, another thing you'll see that the mafia couldn't have done. the way the motorcycle cops protected Kennedy. He was there for 3 days, and they used the standard wedge formation the first 2 days, which is they put the vehicle in the middle, and it's literally surrounded by police officers on motorcycles, making it very difficult to get a clear shot at the president. That was done the first 2 days, but in Dallas, that all changed. The motorcycles, four of them were put a car in front, and the other four were put so far behind that they offered no protection whatsoever to the president. Now, again, violation of standard operating procedures, and Dallas was considered a hostile city at that time. And when you see things like that and facts like that, it becomes clear that if the mafia was involved, which they may have been, because at the time the mafia was in bed with the CIA and they were attempting to assassinate Castro. Now, mob shooters might have been there. They may have provided the gunman. That I certainly am open to. But as far as the whole thing happening the way it did, the mob didn't have the power to control the government itself. And the government itself did things to set Kennedy up that clearly, with the evidence and common sense, like how the motorcycle police were. And the Secret Service actually protected Kennedy more after he was dead that day than they did alive. Because by gunpoint, they stole his body from Texas, because at that time there was no law other than homicide to the murdering the president. Today, as a result of this, it's a federal law to murder the president. But then jurisdiction was Dallas. Homicide. There was no federal law. And in Texas law, it says in any homicide, the autopsy will be performed in Texas. Then you look at what happened to the limousine. Kennedy's car, this is a crime scene. It should have had yellow tape put all around it. No one should have been allowed to touch it until forensics and all the scientists had gone through it and taken the yellow tape down, correct?
Okay.
Well, what happened to the car? Monday morning, on the orders of Lyndon Johnson, a worker went into the Ford Motor Plant up in Michigan and was astounded to see President Kennedy's limo there being stripped, reupholstered, a new windshield, and totally renovation. Monday morning, and there wasn't one police officer that got to look at that crime scene, because the president was killed inside that car. That is a crime scene. That's a homicide scene. Anybody that watches TV, any of these TV crime shows, knows that's homicide 101. The yellow tape goes around and it's investigated. In this case, it wasn't at all.
Question from Max in Ascension Parish, and you do go into this in the book. Were there other plots to kill the president prior to what happened November 22nd, 1963?
Oh, yeah, there was two other plots almost identical that didn't happen, one in Tampa, Florida, and one in Chicago. The president, in fact, they informed him of the breaking of that plot, and he canceled his trip to Chicago. We've researched and found out that they had three options, three places that they were going to get him, either Tampa, Chicago, or Dallas, and they were successful in Dallas.
They were successful, whoever did it. Lee Harvey Oswald, Jesse Ventura believes, was not the assassin on November 22nd, 1963. How many people were firing away, in your estimation?
Oh, I would think you had to have at least a triangular three minimum, but I would say probably that would be the best, and that would be the professional way of doing it. You know, you have three snipers from three different positions, and that the odds increase dramatically that the ultimate result will be successful.
All right, here's a question.
There's no doubt, and there's no doubt in my mind, one, the fatal headshot came from the grassy knoll.
You don't think it came from behind him?
Not about. Read what the Parkland Hospital doctors, every doctor at Parkland Hospital where Kennedy was taken to, including nurses, including FBI men, including Secret Service, initially, the back of the president's head was blown out. And they can tell the difference between an entrance and an exit wound. Many of these doctors were combat experienced. This was a trauma center where they dealt with gunshot wounds on a daily basis. And this is the President of the United States. You think these doctors and nurses at Parkland aren't going to have a clear memory of being in that room attempting to save the president's life? Their memory's going to be perfect. of what happened. And every one of them reading the book, I mean, 8 or 9 doctors all tell you that it was an entrance wound to the front and an exit wound to the back. And even the blood spatter evidence shows that. Kennedy flew back into the left, and the two motorcycle cops that were back way back and couldn't provide protection, their windshields and them were spattered with blood. Well, that how could that happen from a shot from the rear?
Here's a question from
Bruce. The blood's going to fly, and the brain matter is going to fly backwards. The car was almost at a standstill when it was hit.
Bruce on government wants to know if Bill Moyers, of all people, was involved in the cover-up that you cite.
Well, Bill Moyer, I don't know if he was involved in the cover-up, but he worked for Johnson, and he was the initial one to receive the message that we opened the book, the famous Katzenbach message, that this is an official government document that was discovered. Nicholas Katzenbach, the acting attorney general, naturally Robert wasn't at work Monday morning. His brother had been killed on Friday. He sent a memo through Bill Moyer to Lyndon Johnson stating the whole layout of the cover-up. We must convince the public that Oswald acted alone. We must convince the public that had there been a trial, he would have been found guilty. And we must head off any type of unwanted investigations. Well, this is a government memo that went out Monday morning. They hadn't even investigated the crime. Let me tell you how bad it was personally. My mother left a big trunk when she passed away, and at the bottom of that trunk were all the Minneapolis papers of that weekend. I don't know why she kept them. She never told me why she did. My son and I, he was about 14 or 15 then, were looking in the Monday morning Minneapolis paper. Monday morning. Now, that meant it had to go out. There wasn't computer then, Jim, so it had to go out late afternoon Sunday, right after Oswald was killed.
Yeah.
Monday morning, subtitle headline, Minneapolis paper, Dallas declare case closed. Now, not one shred of evidence has been looked at. Oswald didn't confess. He did the opposite. He said he was a patsy. He didn't kill anybody.
Well,
they hadn't investigated a thing, and they were already declaring the case closed Monday morning. My son looked at me at age 15, and here's what his quote was, "Dad, they spend more time on a domestic." And I said, "You're right, son. What do you think of this? I mean, even a 15-year-old kid could read this century or decades later and look at his father in puzzlement going, how could they possibly have declared the case closed Monday morning?
Well, the Katzenbach memo that you cite, which is presented early on in Jesse's book, it says speculation about Oswald's motivation ought to be cut off, and we should have some basis for rebutting thought that this was a communist conspiracy, or as the Iron Curtain Press is saying, a right-wing conspiracy to blame it on the communists. Now, does that necessarily mean that there was a conspiracy?
Absolutely. They're telling you that they're not going to let the facts determine the conclusion, that we have a predetermined conclusion, and these are the things we must do to make sure that that conclusion's successful. Because in the memo, Oswald was the lone assassin. How do they know that Monday morning? How on earth could they possibly know that it was a single lone nut Monday morning? They hadn't investigated a thing. Well, Hoover declared Oswald the killer that day. Now, this is the United States' top law enforcement guy, and they hadn't even investigated. They hadn't looked at one forensic and nothing. And they didn't have a confession. Oswald never confessed. It was funny. I did a TV show on my book tour, and it was lead-in of the TV show. They announced, they called Oswald convicted. Convicted killer Lee Harvey Oswald. I immediately corrected and said, wait a minute. He wasn't convicted of a thing. There was never a trial. See, that's how the media, you know, pollutes the thing. All it takes is one media person to put on convicted and right away subconsciously in everyone's mind that they think, oh, yes, Oswald was convicted. No, he was not.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read this book, you'll clearly see, Jim, the worst lawyer in the world could have got Oswald off. Because these are 63 beyond a reasonable doubt. These are 63 doubts. And any one of them, you only need one to get an acquittal.
Well, you're fascinated with this, obviously. You're born in 1951. I was born in 1958, so I'm fascinated with it. But my guess is that 25 years from now, when we're observing the 75th anniversary of JFK, by then there won't be that many people alive who were alive on November 22nd, 1963. Will this fade away at some point?
I don't know if it'll ever fade away, or will the truth ever come forward at some point. I don't know. You know, let's look at the quickly at the assassination of President Lincoln. I mean, we're led to believe that John Wilkes Booth killed Lincoln really by himself in all our history books, which is totally untrue. There were eight people involved. It was a major big conspiracy. They were also attempting to kill the vice president and the secretary of state. They were only successful with Abraham Lincoln, and eight people stood trial for it. Four were convicted and sentenced to death, including the first woman. Yet you're never taught that in history books. It ends at John Wilkes Booth. Mm-hmm. So it'll be very difficult to determine, and that's the reason I wrote my book, Jim. It's a good segue to it. I wanted forever, for whatever it's worth, 50, 100 years from now when I'm gone, that the people will know that the 38th governor of Minnesota did not believe the Warren Commission and did not believe the official story. And the only way I felt I could do that was to write my own book. And now I'm officially on the record with a book. They'll all know Jesse Ventura's not buying it.
They killed their
president.
There's
nothing they could do to convince me elsewise when looking at all this evidence.
All right. Well, as we round it out, I have had a few people inquire about your opinion regarding the government shutdown.
I think it's despicable. I think it's almost a domestic act of terrorism. And I've come forward already and said, Jim, why should we be required now to pay full taxes? If the government shut down and they're not providing the services to our state parks, to our veterans, to all these things that they normally provide with our tax dollars, why should we be forced to pay full taxes when we're not receiving the benefits of the spending of our money? It's despicable. It sets the table for me to make a run. That's what's scary about it. Everything seems to fall into place because if I did run, and I say if, and that's a big if I did run, I would run on one simple thing, and that was this. I would offer the American people the opportunity to elect the first president since George Washington that does not belong to a political gang. And I refer to them as gangs because they're not parties, they're gangs. And I really believe, Jim, you could win on that in today's day and age. I mean, Congress has a less than 10% approval rating. How horrible is 9 out of 10 people? Can it get any worse?
Well, Jesse Ventura, congrats on a fine work. They Killed Our President is his latest book. And if he runs, he'll be the only presidential candidate who was a Navy SEAL, a best-selling author, and a professional wrestler. Thank you, Governor Ventura.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure. We'll do it again if I write another one.
I hope so. Thank you, Jesse.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. We are joined by John Meese, a well-known actor in Hollywood and elsewhere, who grew up right here in Baton Rouge, educated at LSU, and is back home in his home state for a big production at the Britannia Theater. Good morning, John Meese.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
Doing well. And before we get to The King of Herrings and other things involving John Meese, you were born right before President Kennedy was assassinated.
That's right. You know, it's kind of funny you bring it up because I used to always say that. It's like I'm one of the few people I know that, like, Kennedy was still alive when I was born, and a couple of weeks later. I mean, I'm talking about people that were in school with me and all, you know.
No, November 4th.
Yeah.
You were born November 4th, so you're 18 days old when the president
was
killed. And you grew up at a time in Baton Rouge that was somewhat different than it is now. Do you have fond memories of your youth in this city?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, I moved to Los Angeles about, 24, 25 years ago. But I have come home consistently because my whole family lives there, and, you know, it's home. And we come home any chance we get. Love Baton Rouge, and I love seeing everybody because I feel like I know everybody in the town, you know.
Well, coming this Sunday at the Britannia Theater, The King of Herrings will be unveiled to the masses. This is in New Orleans, of course, and then there will be another showing on Tuesday, the 15th, at 3:45 in the afternoon at the Britannia Theater. This production is like a who's who of Louisiana actors of a certain vintage, and you're in that group along with some other familiar names.
Yeah, it's you know, Eddie Jemison is the writer, co-director of the film, and he stars in it. And then you got David Jensen and Joe Kress and Wayne Perret and Carl Palmer. These guys, all of us together, went to LSU and, you know, studied acting 25 years ago. And here it is, you know, now we got together and made a film. And that, I think, is one of the most amazing things about the film is it's got that history and that, you know, connection between the characters that you can't, I mean, it's hard to make it happen when you just meet somebody and they say Roland, but, you know, there's a lot of history between these guys, and we caught it on film, you know?
Well, I saw you and Eddie Jemison and David Jensen at Louis earlier this week, and you're in
it. Yeah, that was really cool. We bumped into you.
And you're in it with Joe Kress, and the two of you were together on the big screen in Dangerous Proposition.
That's right, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, you were also in that film, right?
I was, yeah. And Carl Palmer, who I went to school with, who recently was Jim Taylor in the play Lombardi in New Orleans, he's a fine actor. So you got a great
cast.
Yeah,
that's got a lot of good reviews on that one. Did you get to see it?
I did not, and I'm sorry I didn't, but I'm sure Carl was exceptional. He's a good actor, too.
Yes, sir.
Well, you are in this film, The King of Herrings. I'm reading one of the reviews, or I'll read a bit from it, an offbeat look at four Crescent City layabouts who dream big in a small change world of cards, women, and endless cups of coffee. Their passionate blundering, like their rants, can be at once funny, poignant, ridiculous, and heartbreaking. Filmed in black and white, this richly textured character study could be the bastard child of Woody Allen and Tom Waits, brought to life by an ensemble of real-life character actors who have known each other and worked together for over 25 years. That sums it up. I look forward to seeing The King of Herrings.
Thank you. I really hope that some people can come out. I'll tell you what, we're almost sold out on Sunday, so if you want to see it on Sunday, I would suggest you get on it. I mean, there might be like 10 tickets left on the Sunday showing, and Tuesday at 3:45 in the afternoon, we're half full. But both these screenings are at the Britannia in New Orleans, and we're real excited that we're getting to show it in such a great venue, and really such a great venue for the film, too. You know, we shot it in New Orleans, and we shot a lot of it in Baton Rouge, too. We shot a scene in a bathroom in Tiger Stadium. So there's a Baton Rouge, New Orleans thing going on here.
Well, John Meese and others in this film, and when I say others, it is a who's who of Louisiana men who have pursued acting, men in their 50s. This film, by the way, was named as the Louisville International Official Selection for 2013. So it's gotten some good reviews. And what was the genesis? How did the King of Herrings develop?
Well, you know, Eddie Jemison and I live in Los Angeles now. We both got kids, and we spent all our time doing that and trying to get jobs as actors. But every Wednesday night, we get together with a group of actors, and we have kind of a class, but we don't really have a teacher. We just bring what we want to bring. Sometimes we write stuff. Sometimes we do classics. You know, sometimes we do film scripts. But we just work on something every Wednesday night as a group. Most of the actors are from Chicago. But, you know, Eddie spent time in Chicago, so there's a connection there. But we're all friends, and we just work on things. And I guess about 2 years ago, Eddie brought a scene in that he just wrote, just one scene, and he wrote it for him and a friend to read in class that night. And it was so good that we just encouraged him to write another scene. And basically, every week he'd bring in a new scene, and 12 weeks later we had almost a whole script on our hands, and everybody was like, this is really good. So we sent it to David Jensen. He read it, and he started talking to John Dennis, who was our acting guru, or, you know, basically for all of us. That's who pulled this together. And John liked it. So the original plan was to kind of do a play. They did a reading of it, and it set the ball in motion. And then, of course, John had health problems and passed away, about a year ago. And so that happened after we shot the film, but he had health problems before, which made us, him pull out of doing the play version. And we kind of said, all right, well, he's already pulled us together, and we got something good here. Let's shoot the film version while we can, and that's what we did.
297-5633, if you have an inquiry for John Meese, a fine actor. He plays Augie in The King of Herrings. Tell us about Augie.
Well, Augie is, these guys, they always hang out at this one diner. We actually shot it at Anita's world-famous cafe on Tulane Avenue, and Augie is the guy that runs the place. That's his, diner. And it really is kind of it's a down-and-out world, and even in the diner, it's like, Augie doesn't have that many customers. these guys come in all the time, and, I'm always hoping they'll order some steak or some food, but mostly they just order coffee because they don't really have any money either. But I'm the guy that kind of runs the thing. So I'm part of their group, but I'm also sort of the one guy that's not as maybe not as caught up in their actions. I'm kind of watching it and maybe giving them a little advice from the side that they could do better than what they're doing right now.
Well, in Dangerous Proposition, John played a menacing character quite convincingly. What kind of roles do you prefer?
I really do, especially early on, I really did enjoy playing, terrible people. like the guy in Dangerous Proposition was exciting to play because, he's up to no good all the time, and it's a little more fun for me to play. And maybe that's because, people tell me because I'm a nice guy, and I guess I am. But for acting, you kind of want to do something outside yourself, and I always did think that was fun. But I'll be honest. This role in King of Herrings, I'm probably the guy that's not mean. You know what I mean? these guys are reprehensible, and I really it may be the smallest role in the film, but I'm real proud of what I did with it because I was comfortable in being myself in the role and not trying to do something more than I needed to, and that's hard to do sometimes. But it's I don't know. I mean, I watch it and I go, that's good work. So. I like acting, and anything they throw at me that's a challenge one way or another is fun to do. I mean, it's it's what we do. We love it.
Well, you do have a few women in the film as well.
Yes, we have Laura Lampson, who is playing Eddie Jemison's wife in the film, and in real life is actually Eddie Jemison's wife. So that was a great thing to see. If only because I've watched Laura every week in that class where we meet. Like, she used to come to class all the time before the babies became too much for her, and she has to stay home with them now. But I've watched her every day for, once a week for, probably 4 or 5 years, and Laura Lampson's truly one of my favorite actresses that I've ever seen work. She's just that good. So this was great to see her get to, be in a film with us, playing a really kind of one of the most important roles in the film is Lars. And then Andrea Frankel, or Andrea Frankel. I always say Andrea, and people correct me. But she plays Eddie's sister, and she's amazing. I don't know if you probably know Andrea, huh? I mean, she does a lot of stuff in Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
She went to LSU, too. And she's working so much. I mean, I can't keep up with the next film she's in. But she came and did it with us, too. And, John Dennis was her acting teacher and all of our acting teachers. And, that kind of brought us all together. That's how we know Andrea. And she's amazing in it, in this and everything I see her in, So we got two great women and a bunch of guys that, have known each other forever.
Now, David Jensen, what kind of a character does he play? His name's Gat, is that right?
Yeah, his name is Gat. And what's cool about this to me with David Jensen is I've seen David play so many amazing things over the years. It's sometimes they're small roles. Sometimes they're just really out there roles. But I never get to see him do what I know he can do. Cause I saw him play Scrooge in A Christmas Carol 25 years ago. And, he owned that play. He owned that story. He was amazing. So you want to get to see him do stuff like that again. And, in this, what's really nice is he's playing kind of just a regular guy. He's Eddie Jemison's best friend. Eddie plays ditch. So it's kind of not, you know, not a bad mirror of some real life situations going on there. They spend a lot of time talking and trying to work out their lives together in the film. And he gets to be more normal. You know what I mean? He gets to be a regular guy, but he's got some issues, and he pops off surprisingly throughout the film in ways that are really exciting to watch. I mean, David is lightning in a bottle every day. I mean, if you be around him for 10 minutes, you're going to see something happen that you're going to be like, where did that come from? That's David Jensen, and that's Gat. You know, he's 1 minute just very level-headed, and the next minute, you don't know what he's going to do.
Well, it's showing The King of Herrings is Sunday at the Britannia, and as John Meese just stated, it's almost sold out. And then Tuesday, about halfway sold out, another showing at 3:45 at the Britannia. After this, where does it go?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, because basically we spent all our time getting it ready, and we tried to get it in a couple of big festivals, but we had our eye on New Orleans Film Festival from day one just because, well, you know, we thought it was a perfect match. So this is the premiere. We do have some meetings with people that are kind of interested in talking about us doing the next film. We have this film called The Affair, which Eddie also wrote. And we're hoping to kind of, like, you know, talk to people that are interested, because there's a lot of people that have seen the film and love it and kind of can't believe what we pulled off for little money. I mean, when I say we made it for little money, we really did. I don't even want to say the dollar figure, but you watch the movie, you know, it stands right next to these, you know, $500,000 films, and you won't see a difference. In fact, hopefully you'll like ours more.
Well.
That's a lot of stuff that's going on with it, and we're going to bring it to some more festivals. Of course, as you said, we've got it in Louisville right now. In fact, it plays in Louisville today at noon. So that's happening, and then we're going to try to see about selling it somewhere, somehow. We're trying to get it in some little independent theaters in big cities and see where it goes, you know. I mean, we want to get it out there. And, I mean, eventually it'll be, you know, on Netflix or something like that.
There you go. Well, John Meese was the Young Alumnus of the Year in 2000 at LSU, has his MFA in acting from Louisiana State University. Born same year, same town as another fellow who's synonymous with the film world, Steven Soderbergh. How did you decide to go to Los Angeles? What propelled that decision?
Well, you know, Jim, I was in advertising at LSU, and I'd say I was about three quarters away getting my degree in advertising. And while I was good at it, I enjoyed it on a level, I was not passionate about it. And the one thing I kept coming back to in my life was movies. I love movies since the first time I saw, you know, Jungle Book at the Balmarshe Theater. And I mean, it always had an impact on me, you know. I saw Gone with the Wind when I was in seventh grade at that same theater. My dad took us through it, like the whole family. And it always had more of an impact than kind of anything else that I did. So I don't think that I realized I could be in movies or, you know, having any kind of connection to it until I got in college and I started taking acting classes. And I really liked acting, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to throw, you know, myself into the pool completely on it. So I graduated in advertising, got my degree, and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? So part of me was thinking I'd go to Los Angeles and start, you know, maybe I would use my advertising degree to advertise movies and make movie trailers and stuff. It was something, but it wasn't super exciting. And then I was at the Village Square Shopping Center, the coffee call.
Yeah.
And I bumped into John Dennis, and I said, hey, John, you know, I just graduated. I'm going to go out to L.A. I'm making some money right now. I kind of want to try out my foot in acting again, but, you know, maybe I can do a play while I'm still in town. And as luck would have it, he was directing The To the Crime by Sam Shepard. And he said, why don't you come in and read this play? And I went over to his office, picked up a copy, read it. I went to Wendy's right next door, sat down, had lunch, read it, and I couldn't put it down. It was the most amazing thing I'd ever read. And I said, John, I want to do this. And he said, well, listen, we already got an actor cast for the lead role, but what I'd like to do is cast you as the understudy. And you could come in and help us get it going before he gets to town, because he's flying in from Los Angeles. And then you'll at least know somebody in Los Angeles when you move there. And I said, that sounds good. And as luck turned out for me, Nathan Cook, who was the actor that was going to play the lead, ended up not being able to come in for the play. So I ended up actually playing the lead in Tooth of Crime, and that was life-changing, you know.
What? We got to go, John. I did want to note. Some listeners have asked. You are the brother of Gordon Meese, the guy who ran for mayor.
That's my brother, my little brother, Gordon Meese. I call him my little brother, but he's about a foot taller than me.
And he finished third last year, I think. So, until Monday, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of the Jim Engster Show are available at wrkf.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.